The same religion that's capable of hideous acts of destruction can also be capable of moments of healing, of restoration, and of hope.
But educate a girl, and you educate her entire family.
There is a son within every person.
When that anger sets in, write it. Write the letters, but don't send them. You never want to leave concrete proof of insanity.
Welcome. Many of you will already know Mr. Shubat. He's on TV all the time. He's on CNN, he's on Fox, he's on ABC, CBS, ABC. You see him quite a bit, especially when things are especially in a crisis moment in the Middle East. As many of you already know, he's a Palestinian-born Muslim who is now quite proudly identifies himself as an American citizen that practices Christianity. Our guest was invited here today because he has an insider's perspective. As a young man, he became a member of the Palestinian Liberation Organization and undertook acts of violence against Israel. The evidence of both his past conduct, experience, and so forth is that he's gotten in a lot of trouble for it, including spending time in an Israeli jail. Mr. Shubat is here today to share some of his experiences and reflections. He's been a powerful voice speaking out against anti-Semitism and what Karl Popper would call the closed society. Before turning over the microphone, I'd like to briefly discuss logistics and make an appeal to each of you. The logistics are that he's going to be speaking for about an hour, followed by a 30-minute open mic Q&A. We're not going to circulate cards. We haven't pre-designated who can ask questions. The microphone is open. Whoever can get up there is going to be able to ask their questions. We ask that you ask questions, not make declarations, not pretend that this event was organized for you. Please ask the speaker questions. Of course, take issue with him. You think he's factually off base or his logic's wrong, go for it. But let's not turn it into a forum for people to take over the microphone. The appeal is as follows. There's been a growing trend at university campuses for small groups of students, and even more sadly, faculty, disrupting events. I have to pause when I say that because it really boggles my mind that we do not anymore hold sacred freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, and the right for students to put together a forum of their choosing. For anybody interested in challenging Mr. Shubat's views, we have an open mic during the Q&A. You're free to come up and talk to him. You're free to go on the blog. You're free to write for the Daily Nexus. You're free to express your views in a lot of different ways. But the speech that's being protected here today is his, and the assembly that is being protected here today is all of ours. And it is our right as students and faculties and members of the community to come here and hear this man express his views without threats or intimidation or shouting. Anybody who engages in heckling or disruptive tactics is just out. And I would just hope that if the Constitution isn't enough, and if the sacred forum that we're in of a university isn't enough, that I would just appeal to you on a human level of courtesy and hospitality to please be kind and allow our speaker to get his thoughts across. Without further ado, I'd like to introduce Mr. Waleed Shubat.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you. Let's get some maintenance here first. I like wooden podiums better than fiberglass. It doesn't show the belly. Although I am not a professional speaker, I sweat blood, basically, before I come and speak to an audience as big as this. But I'm compelled to do it. Why, you might ask? Well, it's a dirty job and somebody has to do it. Fighting terrorism is not easy. Coming out of terrorism is not easy. Living the life of a terrorist is not easy. None of this is easy. Life in itself is not easy. However, as a psychiatrist would say, lie down and start from the beginning. I'd like to give a little background about myself. My name is Waleed Shu'aibat. I come from an American mother and a Palestinian father. Well, my father was Jordanian, and he was born, it wasn't called Palestine. I come from two specters, the opposite sides of the world. A father being from the Middle East, and a mother being from America. My great-grandfather, as a matter of fact, was the mayor of Eureka, California. I don't know if you know where Eureka is. He was a good friend with Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill, we used to visit my grandfather. My grandfather was in the newspaper business, and so was Winston Churchill before he became who he became. And from my father's side, my grandfather was an excellent friend of a notorious person named Hajj Amin al-Husseini. I don't know how many of you knows who Hajj Amin al-Husseini, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. He was well known for certain things I'd like to discuss. Hajj Amin al-Husseini was the founder of the Bosnian division and the Albanian divisions in the Nazi war machine. Let's remember, the Nazi war machine was composed of 8 different divisions. 2 of them were Muslim fundamentalists. They burned 90% and killed 90% of the Jews of Bosnia, burned thousands of churches, and caused extreme havoc all around the Middle East. Hajj Amin al-Husseini used to go in media, just like I'm doing. I go in the media. He used to go in the media all around the Middle East, calling for the destruction of the Jewish people way before the establishment of the State of Israel. Hajj Amin al-Husseini was seen, you can see a picture of him sitting with Adolf Hitler on the eve of the final solution, conspiring with Hitler in the destruction of the Jewish people in the Muslim world. He also was responsible for a massacre in Hebron in the Holy Land. In fact, all the women and the men, the Jewish people, were massacred. A few survived. The few that survived, I have to thank some of the Palestinian community there who helped in saving the lives of Jews as well. So it goes both ways. I started my first recollection when I lived in the Middle East. I remember I was about 6 years old, living in Jericho. I remember the 6 Days War. I don't know how many of you have heard of the 6 Days War. The 6 Days War started in 1967 when 5 Arab armies wanted to destroy Israel, surrounded it, and they were about to strike, and Israel preempted and attacked first and won the battle. My mother, on the other hand, her life is the one that should be told, and I'd like to discuss about her as well. She doesn't like to speak out. She met my father in Humboldt State College. She fell in love, and she got married. She went for a visit after having my brother and my sister. Of course, she was 9 months pregnant with myself. And she went for a visit to the Middle East. She didn't realize when she entered the Middle East for a visit that her husband had planned not to allow her to go back to her country of origin, that was the United States of America. You see a lot of cases of Muslims marrying non-Muslims, and it is okay, it's permissible in Islam for a Muslim to marry a non-Muslim. That you convert her to Islam later on, but you'll never hear of a Muslim girl marrying a non-Muslim boy. It's extremely, extremely rare, because the punishment of a girl who marries out of the faith in Islam is death. Of course, in 55 Muslim states, not one of them is signatory to the Hague Convention, which means if you decide to marry your Muslim spouse and he decides to take the children overseas, there is no laws that can protect you from bringing your kids back. And there is an epidemic of girls. And every place I go speak, I always hear the stories of somebody marrying somebody from the Middle East and taking the girl and not being able to come back. My mother started to realize immediately that she couldn't go back, that the Middle East is like the Hotel California. You know, you can check in and check out anytime you want, but you can never leave. She wanted to escape with her children. She wanted to take all 3 kids and come to America and leave. Her first attempt of escape, She took the kids and she got to Jerusalem, and by the time she went to the embassy, the consulate general, they gave her a bunch of paperwork in which she had to wait one more day, and she stayed at the hotel. And the second day she went back to the embassy to get her passports and what have you. The family were waiting for her on the entrance of the embassy, in which she was caught, of course, and she was sent back to the House of Obedience, in which my father, of course, beat her up and things like that. You might think, as an American, you know, you've heard, you've seen movies, you know, but I'm an American, you know. I remember my mother first walked in one time in a game of a backgammon. She said, "I'm an American, I'm tired, I want to go home." And she picked up the backgammon and she tossed it on the floor. And my father got a mallet and hit her in the head. I remember walking my mother to a nearby church in which the nuns had to stitch her head. At this point, you know, the family and the school, the principal, the teachers, and the whole community started to talk to these three children, me, my brother, and my sister, telling us that, you know, beware of your mother because she's attempting to take you overseas to America. So now the problem became for her is how could she convince the children to run with her to America? She was never able to convince us to go with her. And so we will turn our own mother in if we had an inkling of a thought that we might think my mother wanted to escape. This is why I like to recommend the movie, Not Without My Daughter by Sally Field. It's phenomenal. I remember first I went to school, in Christian school. So before I always, you know, I get always accused of being an Islamophobe because I always like to mention some things that happened in the Muslim world, but maybe I can pick on my Christian friends as well. In the Christian school, third and fourth grade, I remember going to school. I was the only Muslim in the school, and I wasn't basically allowed to study the Bible or go into the Christian studies department. However, I walked in one time, and I wanted to study what other kids studied, so I insisted, and they allowed me to study third and fourth grade in the school Bible studies. But it's not the same Bible studies that you see predominantly in America, because in the Palestinian areas, you could see Hanan Ashrawi, the prominent figure who used to be the right-hand person for Yasser Arafat, used to say that Jesus was a Palestinian from my country. So Jesus, the patriarch, you know, was a Palestinian, Abraham was a Palestinian, Moses was a Palestinian, and the whole thing is cloaked with this Palestinian movement. So the Bible in itself was used as a book to promote this Palestinianism. By the time I went to the regular school, I went to school fifth grade all the way to high school. I remember my educators, Sheikh Naeem Ayyad and Sheikh Zakaria. They were graduates from Al-Azhar University of Egypt. Now, some of you who heard of Al-Azhar University of Egypt, what is that? You know, you might think it's some small university or some small college in the Hicks somewhere. It is the number one university par excellence in the Muslim Sunni world that educates and graduates all the scholars and the clergy that is pumped out all throughout the Middle East. And what kind of education did I study under this Islamic education? Of course, there was a lot of concentration on the studies of eschatology, or the studies of the ends of times from the Muslim perspective. In fact, I had to memorize a few quotes from the Hadith and the Quran as well. I remember the quote that we were given by Sheikh Naeem Ayyad, لا تقوم الساعة حتى تغلب طائفة من المسلمين طائفة من اليهود قيل أين يا رسول الله قال في بيت المقدس وأكناف بيت المقدس, which means that the day of judgment shall not come to pass until the tribes of Islam defeat the tribes of Israel in Jerusalem and the surrounding cities. And then supposedly the trees and the stones will cry out, there is a Jew hiding behind me. Come, O Muslim, come, O slave of Allah, come and kill him. Of course, we take the men and we kill the men and the women. They are spared and things like that. I remember a question and answer time. You know, is it legitimate to have children with these women? Yes. It's called concubines and things like that. One student asked, is it consensual? And the teacher said, it doesn't have to be. And of course, me not understanding, going to my father, who also taught Islamic studies, will confirm what the teacher was saying and approved of what he was saying. No matter where I went, whether I went to the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, where I got my education from Sheikh Ikrimah Sabri, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem currently. And even the Wailing Wall, you know, the Wailing Wall where the Jews worshipped, it was renamed as Ha'it al-Buraq. It is the wall where Muhammad parked his angelic being as he flew from Mecca to Jerusalem, and so on and so forth. Most of these holy places that were Jewish were renamed, such as Rachel's tomb was called Masjid Bilal, the servant of Muhammad, and things like that. As I continued on, of course, we were fascinated and taught a lot of the edicts of Islamic studies and concentration and focus so much on shahada or martyrdom. In fact, I still memorized the verse, وَلَا تَحْسَبَنَّ الَّذِينَ قُتِلُوا فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ أَمْوَاتٌ بَلْ أَحْيَاءٌ عِنْدَ رَبِّهِمْ يُرْزَقُونَ. Do not think that the ones who die in the cause of Allah are dead, but are alive with Allah receiving His blessings regarding martyrdom. So much focus in martyrdom at that time. In fact, my cousin Ra'id, you know, 16-year-old boy, wanted to do his martyrdom operation. His mission was to plant a bomb in Ben Yehuda Street. And of course, if the Israelis find out that you are about to do a bomb operation, sometimes they shoot first and they ask questions later. What do you expect the Israelis to do? Stop the vehicle, roll down your window, you have the right to remain silent, you have a right for a Jewish lawyer, he's 2 shekels, you can make a phone call. It doesn't work that way. They usually set up a blockade and then they shoot everybody in the car and everybody's killed in the car, and that's what happens. So Israeli bullets did kill my cousin Ra'id. Of course, the news media would say a Palestinian was killed by Israelis and things like that and so on and so forth. Of course, I was a very rowdy person when I was young. I started as a graffitist, you know. Terrorism starts like drugs, you know. You start maybe with marijuana, then end up with PCP. You know, you start with, you know, writing graffiti on the wall, get up in the middle of the night to start demonstrations, writing graffiti all over the wall and starting demonstrations in the Temple Mount, throwing stones at the rabbis down at the Wailing Wall, worshipping, and going on demonstrations galore in our areas. I remember one serious demonstration I was in our village, in which the Israelis came, and the guy with the loudspeaker wanted to calm the situation down, and one teenager hit him with a rock, and as he crossed from the fire line, from the burning tires, he didn't realize from the smoke how many teenagers were on the other side. He was instantly grabbed, lost his baton, his shield, everything. We started hammering him on the head. My cousin, my friends, also one of my friends had a nail in his hand and with a stick, and he was pounding it on his head. He was bleeding like a fountain. And in the final moments, it's about an attempted lynching of this Israeli soldier. He rolled down from the fire line, right through the fire, and went to the other side where he was rescued. I went and told my father. He didn't believe me. He turned on the television. It was headline news that night. And of course, he realized that how come his son knew. Before he even hit the media, he then believed what I've done. He wasn't happy because at this time, you know, Israelis sometimes will, you know, if you've done some terrorism, they'll blow your house up. Of course, I continued with my lifestyle and then ended up proving myself worthy of a further operation. I was recruited in prison. I ended up in prison, of course, arrested, thrown in prison. And in prison, I was recruited by a notorious bomb maker by the name of Mahmoud al-Mughrabi. He was proud to have put 15 explosive charges in Israel. He was being bailed out by a Jewish lawyer by the name of Liat Se'emel. There was 2 Jewish lawyers who was defending Palestinians at that time, Liat Se'emel and Felicia Langer. And, of course, he was released, and I rendezvoused with him on the old city of Jerusalem, in which he assembled an explosive charge. And the Waqf Muslim Waqf police, I don't know if you know what Waqf means, it's the police, the religious police that was supposed to be in charge of protecting the Temple Mount, knew of our operation, smuggled me through the Temple Mount and off a special exit where I avoided the checkpoints in the old city of Jerusalem. And then I went to Bethlehem and I planted the bomb. And before I wanted to plant the bomb, I saw some Arab children walking about around about Bank Laomi Israel in Bethlehem. And I didn't want to kill Arabs, so I ended up tossing the explosive charges in the roof, hoping that the roof would collapse. It exploded, and no one was killed. Later on, of course, I came to the United States of America, and in the United States of America, I entered into this activism at the university campuses. I was in charge of the Palestinian Student Association in Chicago Loop, and our mission, basically, I was an interpreter. And my mission, basically, working with CETA, a government program, American government program, to help students, and we transferred this office to become sort of a headquarter for activism, in which I was doing translation work. I remember we were doing events in which we invited people from the community and, promoted people from the Middle East and Muslims and what have you to come over so they can fund operations and fund events, sending money and finances to help the PLO and sending recruits to Lebanon and things like that. I remember my translation work. It was the standard. My Arabic placards that we hung on the walls around the college will be talking about rivers of blood. Bring your friends. We will be raising funds. We will recruit. We will death to Israel, death to America, down with Zionism, and you know, the regular slogan. The Jordanians definitely didn't like us for Black September when the PLO attempted to oust King Hussein and to take over the Jordanian government and establish a Palestinian state over there. And I wanted something more puritanical. At that time, there was a figure who came from Jordan. His name was Jamal Saeed. He started recruiting students all over for the Muslim Brotherhood. I don't know how many of you heard of the Muslim Brotherhood. It started in Egypt. In fact, Tariq Ramadan, the grandson of Hassan al-Banna, the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood, was invited to speak in Canada. He's not allowed to come to America because of his aiding and abetting terrorist movements. Jamal Saeed was also friends with a notorious person named Abdullah Azzam. Abdullah Azzam was the mentor of Osama bin Laden. Most Americans don't know that Abdullah Azzam was a Palestinian from Jenin. And this is why I ran into trouble talking to the media. Like when I was in Europe, I was speaking to Reuters. And when I talked to Reuters, I remember asking the guy in Reuters, I said, do you know who was the founder of Al-Qaeda? Basically, who's the person that spearheaded Al-Qaeda? And he said, of course, it's Osama bin Laden. I asked him the question also. I said, do you see a difference between Al-Qaeda and Hamas? And his response was, well, Al-Qaeda is not a legitimate organization. It wants to kill anybody and everybody. However, Hamas should be a legitimate organization because Hamas is fighting for the rights of the Palestinian people. So I asked him, well, who was the mentor of Osama bin Laden, who was the spearhead behind all these movements? And he said, of course, Osama bin Laden. I said, wrong, it's Abdullah Azzam, a Palestinian from Jenin. Well, a Palestinian from Jenin is the same thing as a Hamas activist in the Palestinian areas would think in the same concepts as people from Al-Qaeda. There's no difference between the leaders of Hamas in the thinking process and the principles that they followed versus the people who spearheaded Al-Qaeda. This is why Americans always think that we are at war with Al-Qaeda. If you remove Al-Qaeda, then you remove terrorism. The misconceptions in the media was astonishing to me. As I remember even going to the BBC at one point in time. Going to the BBC, they had three scholars who wanted to sort of debate with me about the issues. And unfortunately for the BBC, they put the whole program live. And as I started to discuss the root causes of terrorism, it's not simply just the people who want a land. Or it's not simply people who live in poverty. It's not simply a desire to make a state. There is much bigger issue with Islamic fundamentalism, and it is a desire to establish a utopian government throughout the whole world. And one of the comments with the interviewers said, Mr. Shubat, you must admit it always takes two to tango. I says, no, sir, it doesn't usually take two to tango. Sometimes there's a rape, there's a rapist, and there's a rape victim. It's not two to tango, only one tangoed. And again, if it always takes two to tango, can you tell me what did the Jews do in Nazi Germany to tango? He didn't know what to say, so his colleague wanted to help him, and he says, but Mr. Shabbat, the problem with today's world is fundamentalism. You hear that a lot. Fundamentalist Jews, fundamentalist Christians, fundamentalist Muslim, they all kind of lumped up in the same place, and they're all a problem. Fundamentalism is the problem with today's world. I said, I see where you're going with this, because I guess I'm a Christian fundamentalist, and we are the same thing as a terrorist. Of course, many will always accuse me from going from one extreme to the other, because I became Christian. I says, you know, us as Christians, we admit, we confess that we give the world a headache, because we proselytize. Christians proselytize, especially evangelical Christians. We proselytize, we give the world a headache. But a Muslim fundamentalist will take the whole head right off. Don't you see there is a difference there? Of course, at this point he says, thank you for stopping at the BBC. So I learned quickly that means get out. I, of course, living in America, I remember all the activism that we were doing at the university campuses and things like that. What Jamal Saeed was doing. Jamal Saeed, 2 months ago, just give you an example. 2 months ago had a ribbon celebration, you know, cutting a ribbon in Chicago. And the mayor of Chicago attended where the mosque, the Bridgeview Mosque, which he is the imam of, donated a park for the community from the Muslim finances here to show the friendliness of the Muslim community of Chicago. However, I have videotapes that if I showed you of the kind of things that we were being trained in the heartland of America by Sheikh Jamal Saeed. He used to bring speakers related to Abdullah Azzam. And if I show you the footage of what was going on at hotels that were rent, and you see huge Muslim communities coming to attend the events, you would think that the clip came out of Gaza. But no, it came out of the heartland of America. This was happening right here in America. In all the major cities in America in which they started these activities by the Muslim Brotherhood, which gave birth to the IAP, the Islamic Association of Palestine, which gave birth to CARE, Council of American Islamic Relations, who are ready to sue anybody who says anything. And the clip I would love to show you, I don't have it with me, but if you like, I'll be glad to post it on my website. This way you can click on it and see it for yourselves. You would see Hamas leaders from the Palestinian areas on a platform like this, talking about all the reports, who they assassinated, who they killed, where they dumped their bodies, what bus they blew up, martyrs, names, details. You would see students coming up to the platform with knives in their hand. They're dancing in joy. You would see Quranic recitation on the platform, in which the favorite verse that was being recited was فَإِذَا لَقَيْتُمِ الَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا فَضَرْبُوا الرِّقَابِ. If you meet the unbelievers, then strike off their heads. And you would see the community there chanting Allahu Akbar in a frenzy fashion. It's unlike anything you've seen before. Now they go and disperse back into the community. Guess what? They're decent, nice citizens of this country, and they're just law-abiding citizens. It is amazing to me because I came out of the system. You must understand that for you to understand the Middle Eastern ways of doing things, you must also speak Arabic. You must translate what they say in Arabic and not what they say in English. I mean, I remember Americans would come to us, and we were sitting down as students, and they, you know, start chatting with us and talking to us, and of course, we will agree with them. Hitler was, you know, a butcher, whatever, and as soon as they left, I remember the joke we used to like to say, we hate Hitler too, because he never got the job done. That was kind of the norm. I remember even going to work here in America. I went to work during the Gulf War in a computer department. And I remember, you know, the employees would huddle around the television when Scud missiles would be being lobbed at some American facilities and what have you, and they'll be saddened over the deaths of Americans, and I would act saddened as well. But as soon as I got in my car, got on the freeway, I would roll down my window to get my frustration out and screamed, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Allah is great, Allah is great. I was very elated, very happy at the losses. Go to my apartment complex, which was also had Arab community living there. All my friends would come, and we would be watching the news and CNN, and we'd be all supporting the other side. I don't know how much you know about the American Muslim Council or CARE, when Abdul Rahman Al-Amoudi, the head of the American Muslim Council, stated equivocally to the whole community that he supports Hezbollah, and he supports Hamas, and he supports Al-Qaeda, and all these things. And this was caught on tape. He didn't realize it was caught on tape. And openly, he says, you know, when we are in the Middle East, we have a right to say that we support Hezbollah. When we are in the Middle East. But when in America, we would say we would denounce terrorism. This is why you see groups like CARE, who say, you know, we denounce terrorism. You know, we don't approve of terrorism. But it seems like organizations like CARE are simply interested in suing or in going after Islamophobes like myself. The question is, to fight terrorism is not just words. To fight terrorism is an action. What do you see these groups doing as action to fight terrorism? What do they do? Do they fund operations to catch terrorists? Do they turn them in? Do they help and aid the FBI or the CIA in catching these people? This is not the case with these organizations. Of course, in my life, you get married. You know, I got married with a Catholic girl, and I wanted to convert her later on into Islam. And then I told her that it's time for her to adopt my Islamic faith. Excuse me. And she said, well, why should I leave my Christian faith? I says, well, you know, the Bible is a document that was corrupted. Muslims generally believe that the Bible has been corrupted. The Jews corrupted the Old Testament, the New Testament was corrupted by the Christians, and what have you. She says, well, where are the corruptions? I said, well, I don't know. I never really read one. She says, well, how do you claim something you never read? Well, that was a good question. So I went and purchased one for $10, and I started to read it to find the corruptions. And what happened after that is I really began to fall in love with the document. That was my first crime. I fell in love with it because I saw so many things that it projected into the future. I saw, let's say, in Psalm 83, it talked about a battle of different countries coming against Israel, the very things we learned in Islamic eschatology, but the outcome of the battle that is the loss of these armies that comes against Israel, and it mentions them by name, and they are all the same armies that surrounded Israel in the Six-Day War. And I began to see the Jewish connection from the Torah and things like that to the land of Israel. I began to ask myself many questions. I began critical thinking. Critical thinking began to enter this Middle Eastern mind. I took a trip to Israel. I began to question and look and observe. I never really spoke to a Jew in my life, except behind the fire lines, bad language and things like that. I sat next to a Jewish lady flying from Rome to Ben Gurion Airport. And I wanted to strike a conversation with this Jewish lady. I didn't want her to know that I was Palestinian. So I did not roll my R's. I says, ma'am, my name is Bill, I'm from California. And I'm visiting the Holy Land, and I'd like you to tell me some things about the Holy Land. And she started talking, of course, and I wanted to get to know her better. I asked her, I says, do you have any children? She said, yeah, I got two daughters serving in the IDF. I said, oh, how impressive. Your daughters are serving in the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces. Ma'am, how do you feel when your daughters kill Arabs? I mean, they're in the IDF, they shoot Palestinians, they kill them indiscriminately and all kinds of things like that. How do you feel when your daughters kill Arabs? She was very sad. She said, I pray all the time that it would never happen. We love Arabs. I said, maybe she uncovered my cover. She said, we love Arabs. We have no problems with Arabs. We love Arabs. And she started sobbing. You know, she started quoting Golda Meir, you know, we will have peace, when the Arabs will love their children more than they hate us. And I gave him a handkerchief, and I got off Ben Gurion Airport. And of course, in Ben Gurion Airport, your passport says Jordan. Of course, you go to a different section for questioning. And of course, by the time you finish the questioning, you go out to a different side of the end of the airport, and you curse the Israelis because they mistreat the Palestinians, because how come we are divided? You know, American tourists can go with no problems, and Israelis with no problems, but Palestinians have to be overly searched. I complain, of course, my uncle, my father picked me from the airport. We complain about the occupation and the mistreatments and all kinds of things like that. But however, I began to think now, after 9/11, the very things that Palestinians go through in checkpoints and things like that, all Americans have to go in the airport. You go to the airport, you get checked nowadays. It didn't used to be that way. But you must understand why they have to check you in the airport, because after 9/11, things are not safe anymore. So now you also, Americans, could live the life of Palestinians. However, you guys had nothing to do with this terrorist. Then I took a trip with my uncle, and in the trip, I wanted to see the Holy Land, and I could not find a square meter of wall all around the communities, wherever I went, whether it's Ramallah, Nablus, Hebron, everywhere I went, you could not find a square meter of wall that did not have graffiti. Now, you might think in your American mind, maybe that's gang graffiti. No. Things like, نَقْرَعُ أَبْوَابَ الْجَنَّةِ بِجَمَاجِمْ الْيَهُودِ. We knock on the gates of heaven with the skulls of Jews. I remember my critical thinking mind started asking questions. Uncle, what does that have to do with establishing a state? Why must we knock on the gates of heaven with the skulls of Jews in order to establish a state? This has nothing to do with a state. This is a desire to go to heaven. Why must we kill to go to heaven? Isn't there a better method to go to heaven? They didn't like me that much. I was asking too many questions. And I went to Hebron then. I took a taxi cab. I went to Hebron. And in Hebron, I ran into a turning point that kind of started to change my mind. By the time I got to Hebron, I saw a bus, a Jewish bus, that picked up the Jewish community of Kiryat Arba. Now, this bus, you have to understand, you could hardly see the bus, because as soon as the bus came, the Arab demonstrators came over there from nowhere and started to lob stones at the bus. You could hardly see the bus. You might think stones here, it's like a pebble, you know. Stones, hundreds of stones just being at the bus. And you could look at the bus, you can see bars and wire mesh and bulletproof glass surrounding the bus with the Jewish community inside. They were living like inside of a cage. And I began to ask myself, I asked the driver, I said, how come we stone this bus? He says, well, of course, they're Jews. I said, why are Jews not allowed to live amongst us? That's a fair question. How come there is 1.2 million Arabs living in Israel proper, and mosques galore, they pray all the time. Any Muslim can go to Israel proper and pray towards Mecca. No harassment whatsoever. Why is it that Jews are not allowed to live amongst us Arabs? Are we more special than they are? How come their communities have to be dismantled? Later on, of course, Joseph's tomb in Shechem, Nablus. The entire community came and they torched Joseph's tomb. They urinated on the Torah scrolls, and they started to paint the dome green, and smoke, and they chiseled on the stones, and the entire, you know, and especially after the Oslo Peace Accord, when the Palestinian authorities had promised to keep intact all Jewish holy places. All Jewish holy places in the Palestinian areas were desecrated, all of them. In fact, the very birthplace of Jesus of Nazareth in Bethlehem. You know, Muhammad Abayat, a well-known terrorist, he was finally killed by the Israelis. My cousin Nidal was injured in the process. Of course, the United Nations issued edicts that, you know, he was a victim. Two ladies from my family got killed in the operation when Israelis killed Muhammad Abayat. He was a very well-known terrorist. He hijacked the entire church and threatened the monks and stole the golden crosses and what have you. And all these notorious things. You would see Muslims also praying in front of the Nativity Church, declaring that in the future it's going to be converted to a mosque. You see Al-Maslama, who's in charge of Hamas nowadays, in Bethlehem, telling the Christian communities that very soon you will have to start paying the jizya taxation. I don't know if you know what a jizya taxation is. This is why I like to say many of these edicts that Hajj Amin Husseini called for came from the Umar Declaration. In the Muslim history, even under Harun al-Rashid, the golden era of Islam, Jews would have to put yellow patches on their right shoulder. Most Americans think when they see the footage in the Holocaust that the yellow patches that were in the soldiers, on the shoulders of the Jews, they think it came out of Nazi Germany. That's not true. It came from Spain, as it was adopted under Islamic Sharia, in which under Al-Mutawakkil or Harun al-Rashid, Jews would have to put yellow patches on their right shoulder. And if you look at the edicts of Nazism, and you look at the edicts of the Umar Declaration, you will find them to be almost exactly the same. Jews must put yellow patches on their right shoulder, both in Nazi Germany and the Umar Declaration. Or let's not forget who Umar ibn al-Khattab is. Umar ibn al-Khattab was one of the 10 disciples of Muhammad. He was the second Khalifa of Islam. Jews must never build their houses above a Muslim house. Jews must never build their synagogues above a mosque. Jews must never enter into Muslim bathhouses. Jews must pay the jizya taxation in accordance to the Quran. حتى يدفع الجزية عن يد وهم صاغرون. Exactly what happened in Nazi Germany, which Jews had to pay double the taxations as Germans did for protection money, what have you. Jews were never allowed to be a judge in a Muslim court. You see that throughout all parts of the Muslim history, whether it's al-Mamalik, al-Rashidin, al-Abbasiyin, all the different eras of Islam, you see these edicts being implemented in the Muslim history. Now, what I said here is very offensive to some of my Muslim friends. It's very offensive. They will say that me criticizing or critiquing these elements is racism. Now, that's a very crucial point, because I would agree with them. It is racism, and it is Islamophobic only and if you lived in Saudi Arabia. If you live in Saudi Arabia, it's illegal to say the things I am saying. I cannot say what I'm saying in my country. However, in America, it is not illegal, and it's not even considered racism. It is not racism to critique a religion. I see some Jewish folks in the crowd. I mean, Jews in general, especially religious Jews, don't believe that Jesus is the Messiah, right? Christians don't believe Joseph Smith is the prophet of God. Because if they do, they'll be Mormon. If Jews believe Jesus is the Messiah, they'll be Christian. It is not illegal to deny that Muhammad is not a prophet. I changed my mind in 1993. I have decided that Islam is not for me, and I decided that I don't believe that Muhammad is a prophet of Islam. This stuns people who come from the Muslim background because they're not used to this kind of thing. It is considered racism and an Islamophobe. However, when I was a terrorist and I wanted to kill Jews and I wanted to make jihad and all these things, the world labeled me as a freedom fighter. Now that I love Jews and I love Muslims and I love Hindus and I love everybody else, now I am being considered a racist. Can you go and figure that one out for me? But that's the way the world we live in now, in which it's very offensive, even if the Pope says something. He says, Islam must never be, spread by violence. And it's offended millions in the Muslim world because it was a lie what the Pope says. What the Pope said was not true. Islam is not violence. And they expressed it by violence. And then hush, hush, and nobody can say anything. In fact, I went one time to a synagogue and I spoke at a synagogue. I was invited in Yom Kippur to speak at a synagogue in which I spoke, and also a Muslim spoke at the synagogue. He was considered a moderate Muslim. And I remember the rabbi made a comment. He says, the New Testament is riddled with violence. I said, well, excuse me. I will die for your right to say the New Testament is riddled with violence, even though I'm a Christian. I will die for your right to say it, because it's a freedom of expression. We have to have that freedom and liberty to express what we want. But Rabbi, when was the last time that you ever said that the Hadith is riddled with violence? He had nothing to say. And then the moderate speaker, I remember asking him a question. I said, did Muhammad, the prophet of Islam, kill the Jews of Banu Qurayda in Saudi Arabia? Remember, there was three Jewish tribes in Saudi Arabia and Khaybar, the second holiest city to Islam, in which the Prophet Muhammad ordered the extermination of the men of the Jews of Banu Qurayda and the extradition of the Jews of Banu Nadir and Banu Qaynuqa. He said, of course it's true that he ordered the killing of the Jews of Banu Qurayda. I mean, they did. They were killed. That's true. However, Mr. Shu'aybat, they had a fair trial. I said, really? How come the Pope make amends to Israel? You know, even the Pope make amends to Israel, admitting some of the things the Catholic Church did. Christians will confess Martin Luther wrote the Jews and their lies and all things like that, which Hitler used, the atrocities in the Crusaders and all these things. We are not ashamed to confess these things. It's part of the process of healing. When we confess these things, we heal. You know, all of us, we become friends again and things like that. How come there is no confessions in the Middle East regarding those things? Well, of course, the problem of the cause is the annihilation of the Jews started from the top. So it's very difficult for Muslims to say, we apologize about the killings of the Jews of Banu Qurayda. In any way, fashion, or form, they must find fault at the Jews of Banu Qurayda to be eliminated. And I began to ask myself more questions. I began to see my own country convert into what I call the night of the living dead, in which you see a couple cameramen by accident there in Ramallah, in which you see the entire community of Ramallah gathered to execute two reservists who got lost in Ramallah. And of course, instead of being hospitable to the stranger, you take him and you kill him, and a frenzy breaks out in the community, and somebody with a camera there, astonished at this thing, he videotapes the whole thing with these thousands of men, the entire city of Ramallah there practically, dancing in joy as they won the lottery with hands, bloody hands from the window and this kind of thing. And I began to think, I said, all my life, we accused the Jews of a blood libel. All my life, I learned the Jews manufacture matzah blood by killing Christian boys. In fact, you might think I'm crazy, I just fell from Mars, but Dracula is a very interesting cartoon that was being viewed all throughout the Middle East, in which Sharon, supposedly in this cartoonic caricature in this cartoon, he was killing Arab children, manufacturing their blood in a can called Dracula, you know, Coca-Cola, Dracula. And you see Sharon drinking the blood. Children would watch this, millions all over the Middle East. And we accused the Jews of this blood libel. Yet here we were carrying out the blood libel literally. You know, my country has become the night of the living dead. And the world media and this whole, you know, Western concept about terrorism simply doesn't get what's going on. And then you see collaborators, you know, like myself. I'm considered now an Israeli collaborator because I'm a sympathizer for the survival of Israel. What happens to a few collaborators that were caught? They were lynched upside down in Bethlehem or in Ramallah. And you see them gutted out with their lungs and their hearts and their kidneys and what have you. And they put the stuff on a platter. And you see men and children, you know, coming to take a piece of part of the flesh, praising Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, in a euphoric, frenzy fashion. I begin to ask myself, what is going on? I know what's going on. I was part of the system. Islamic fundamentalism is really a cult-like process, but not like a cult that's secluded. It's a cult-like process that uses illusions of misery that is always blamed on international Zionism and imperialism. It's the process of indoctrinating these masses in unison, just as you see in Nazi Germany, in order to convert them to seek death or victory over the world, in which they want to establish a utopian government, theocratic utopian government, in which Muslims are dominant and non-Muslims are subservient. You might think, as a Westerner, that this cult-like process exists in secluded areas. This doesn't happen, you know, in normal societies. Well, let me remind you of Nazi Germany. Nazi Germany is a reality in which millions of people ended up dying, gypsies and Jews and what have you, and they were converted in unison. This is reality in the Middle East, in which even Al-Arabiya Network does a survey when they surveyed 113,000 Arabs in the Middle East during the elections, the Palestinian elections, asking the question, do you prefer Hamas, which is a Muslim fundamentalist radical organization, or do you prefer the PA, the Palestinian Authority? 73.2% chose Hamas. These are not my surveys. These are Arab surveys. 113,000 Arabs seem to be an excellent qualifier for a real serious survey here. The PEW, Pew, you know, they have also surveys in which in Pakistan, the majority of Pakistanis want Islamic fundamentalism. In most of the Middle East, in Jordan even, which is considered a moderate government, the majority would support an Islamic fundamentalist government. At one time, the king had to dismantle the Muslim parliament because elections and voting and democracy in those systems might very well elect an Islamic fundamentalist state. In fact, I've been saying this since 1993, and people were laughing at me. I have said in 1993 that Palestine will turn into an Islamic radical government by election and by voting. People thought I was crazy. Yet you have it today. Hamas was elected. They don't get along with the PLO and this and what have you. Of course, Americans in their mindset thought that they were going to establish this beacon of democracy in Iraq. So then they had elections in Iraq, and of course you could see the writing on the wall that the majority Shia won the elections, and now it is going to be very much tied into Iran, in which it has a proxy rule in Syria, which is the government is an Alawite government, Shia government, and in Lebanon, which was a Christian country, a moderate Christian country, ended up becoming now an Islamic almost country, and a takeover of Lebanon is on the way, in which the military power now resides with Hezbollah. Americans think that these are terror organizations. They don't understand that terror organizations can become fledgling states. What Americans also don't understand is that you potentially could have more than one Nazi Germany here. I mean, the American government relies on one person in Pakistan, and that is Musharraf. If Musharraf is ousted, and you have elections in Pakistan, you can rest assured that Pakistan will be an Islamic fundamentalist state with a nuclear weapon. Not without, with a nuclear weapon. You potentially could have several Nazi Germanies here, not one, 10, 20, what have you, in the future. And then let's try to fight these wars on all these fronts. It's a very serious problem. Americans also have a problem with identifying the enemy. Why? Because the moment you begin to identify the enemy, you're being labeled as an Islamophobe. And who's labeling you the Islamophobe? It's these groups like CARE, Islamist Movement in America, disguising themselves as moderate Muslims, and they all believe that. The Jews had a fair trial, of course. And these moderate Muslims are pressuring everybody in the university, and people like myself, to keep your mouth shut and not to criticize Islamic fundamentalism. Well, if we keep this up, this country also will become like France or like in England. And I don't know if you have lived in France or England. Maybe you want to live there, but I don't want to live in France. And I don't want to live in England, definitely, where Al-Muhajirun could walk and roam around the street. And as a matter of fact, I have debated the leader of Al-Muhajirun in England. I went to Ireland and had a debate on television with a notorious terrorist leader from Al-Muhajirun. I didn't have to say much, and the stuff that he started to spew was something that comes out of the Night of the Living Dead. Why is he preaching differently than the Islamists preach here? It's because now they have a big dominant force there, and they grow in numbers. And when you see this growth in numbers, like in Lebanon, you can rest assured that Lebanon is finished. Bethlehem, my village that I grew up in which 80% was Christian, now it's 20% Christian with 80% dominating Muslim fundamentalist population. And all the Christians from Bethlehem, a lot of them are leaving by the droves, and I speak to them on the phone, of course. They don't dare even come out in the media because they still have relatives over there. And what happens to people like me? I mean, if you're in doubt and maybe you have the courage and you want to do the litmus test, maybe you could go to say, well, you know, come on, Wally, what are you talking about? You know, that can't be real. Why don't you try, go to Gaza maybe, and be a conscientious objector, put a little kippah on your head, skull cap, you know, Jewish skull cap, and carry a sign that says, suicide bombing is evil. And let me know how long you live. I will make a bet with you if you're interested, a few thousand dollars, but again, you must come back alive. If you come back dead, I don't know how to collect the money, so you must pay up front to some middleman, so I make sure I collect. Excuse me. Islamic fundamentalism believes in salvation. And this is the argument that I always have. Muslim concept rejects the idea of atonement. Christians have the idea of atonement. You know, by the death of Christ, if you believe in that, you will be saved. One man dies for all humanity in order for mankind to be saved. Now, they reject that because Jesus never died on the cross and no one can atone for somebody's sin. However, if you look at the reality in the Middle East when martyrs die, they go in turn to heaven and intercede for 70 members of their family. You might ask the question, why suicide? Suicide is caused by frustration, poverty, occupation, what have you. There is, you know, and most Americans think even that most terrorists in the world are Muslim. That's not true. Most terrorists in the world are not Muslim. There are, well, maybe that's true, but not all terrorists in the world are Muslim, because you have the PFLP, the Popular Front to Liberate Palestine, by George Habash. He's a Christian. And a lot of the recruits are Christians as well. But the different thing that you see when the PFLP wants to have a suicide mission, they send out Muslims for the suicide mission. You will never see a Christian Palestinian blow themselves up. Why? I mean, if both of them are complaining about the occupation, there should be the same amount of percentage of frustrated Palestinians from the Christian communities who are blowing themselves up, just as much as Palestinians from the Muslim community who are blowing themselves up. Why the ratio is 100% Muslim and 0% Christian? You must start to think it's an issue of salvation, because there is no assurance, unlike Christian dogma, there is no assurance of salvation in the Islamic religion. The only way to assure yourself salvation is by going to paradise as a martyr, again in accordance to the Quranic verse, وَلَا تَحْسَبَنَّ الَّذِينَ قُتِلُوا فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ أَمْوَاتٌ بَلْ أَحْيَاءٌ عِنْدَ رَبِّهِمْ يُرْزَقُونَ. Do not think that the ones who die in the cause of Allah in jihad are dead, but are alive with Allah, receiving His blessings. Not only that, but interceding for 70 members of their family, and they will also in turn go to paradise. So the Muslim dogma, the Islamic fundamentalist dogma, does have intercession and does have the idea of atonement. It's not void of it. In fact, my Aunt Fatima, when my cousin Ra'id went on his bomb operation, she had a wedding celebration in the community. This is something Americans cannot fathom. If I can take your minds for a while and travel you back to the way I lived, the way we live back home, so you can understand what it's like. The community will come, congratulate my aunt, and it will be like a wedding, you know, you know, that kind of thing. I don't know if you heard Arab weddings. And, you know, people will line up, they'll walk in a wedding procession, because this guy is not dead. He is now in heaven with Allah, receiving his blessings, the virgins and what have you. Sort of like reversalism. You know, funerals are weddings, joy is sadness.
theaters have to be destroyed, little bars, you know, have to be closed down, and what have you. And it's basically a wedding procession. Some of the misconceptions that Americans have is that in the Middle East, the reason is, I mean, some people ask me the question, they say, well, how come you don't find people like you coming out and speaking out? How come there's not much dissident? Where are the dissidents? Where are the conscientious objectors in the Middle East? You know, in the Jewish community in America, I mean, I talk to thousands of Jews, and it's almost like 50-50. 50% would support Palestinians and have sympathy for a Palestinian state, and, you know, and you got the right-wing movement, don't support it. So there is a point of view that is different, but you don't find the same thing in the Islamic world. And that is because in the Middle East, loyalty comes before truth. It is important to be loyal. In fact, I had many Arabs, after I finished my lecture, would say, shame on you. Yeah, the things you say are true, but you ashamed us because it is an issue of a pride. I says, well, you know, I can put pride aside for the sake of saving lives. Because the problem is not here, the Israeli occupation only. We blame everything on the Israeli occupation. Occupation, 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 occupation. That's all you hear on TV. Occupation, occupation, occupation. But what about the occupation of the millions of minds, hearts, and souls of youth the same age as you are, all over in Iran, in Pakistan, in Jordan, in Egypt, in Syria, and all these things? I began to ask myself a question one time. I said, why is all our Palestinian songs filled with death, blood, guts, and gore? I mean, maybe I can share with you some of the songs that I've learned as a teenager. I memorized all the Palestinian songs. You can give me any word in the dictionary, and I'll find a song for you. One of the songs goes like this. Let me translate that for you. Sharpen my bones and sharpen them and make them swords. Fill me up a Molotov cocktail. We are a knight. We are a people who cracks through the night and makes their bodies into bombs, converts the bodies into bombs. Or another song, it goes like this. Ya gatilin damkum halal alayna. O Jews, regarding the Jews, O killers, your blood is halal to us, kosher to us. Where will you hide from us in that day? What day? The day when the Muslim will surround Jerusalem and, you know, kill all the Jews and things like that. And then I began to do a research. I began to start looking into Jewish songs. I wanted to learn more about my enemy, culture, heritage, religion, everything. I remember buying so much Jewish paraphernalia, CDs and tapes, and I remember even memorizing a lot of these songs in Hebrew, even though I didn't understand Hebrew. I listened to them so much, I memorized them. I was looking for words that I can get that says kill or war, and this, you know, marching wars, wars of, you know, things that, you know, kind of elates the soldier to fight. How do they fight these wars without war songs? I could never find a Jewish song that had the words war or kill in them. How are the Israelis fighting these wars without war songs? I finally found a song that had the word milhama, milchama. Milchama means what? Butchery, malhama in Arabic. Butchery, war. I found the song. The Jews have violent songs. I was crushed. I took the song to a group of Jewish students. I was trying to interpret it fully. And I said, what is it really saying? He says, sorry to bust your bubble. It says, and the Gentiles will not learn war any longer. And that came from the book of Isaiah, one of the famous Jewish songs. Lo yasa goy el goy cherev, velo yalmadu od milchama. That's amazing. I began to understand that we were at war here with the drug pushers and the occupation of the mind that needed to be liberated from the millions of Muslims. I began to understand life more seriously. I began to do critical thinking. I began to understand that my mind was isolated. I began to recognize finally that the Holocaust was not a fabrication, as Mahmoud Abbas used to say. Even Mahmoud Abbas, the moderate prime minister of Palestine, he wrote his thesis in his graduation, denial of the Holocaust. It's classic. There is no acceptance of the Holocaust in the Middle East. Where is the Yad Vashem Holocaust memorials in the Middle East? Do you see any? Where is the libraries that teach kids about the Holocaust? How come such denial of the Holocaust? I remember I, as a Palestinian, watched more footage on the Holocaust than you Americans. Because I was in Israel. Israel would show footage of the Holocaust all the time. You might think that would educate the teenagers and make them kind of understand the Jewish plight. It doesn't work because we enjoyed watching the Holocaust. We either denied it or we blamed it on Hitler. I remember even asking questions in my class. You know, you complain about your education system in America? Well, let me show you some of my education system. In the class, asking questions, is this footage real? Some teachers will say, no, it's not real. It was all a fabrication. It was all an enactment. Wow, the Jews have no shame. They take their clothes off. They pile themselves on top of each other, nude and naked, in order to establish a Zionist state. You know, such was the education of my school. And once I started to learn the reality, the Holocaust was true, and there was an Islamic fundamentalist involvement in the Holocaust, I started to ask myself why all my life I was lied to. Why all my life I was a victim of the drug pushers. Could I be right and everybody in my community wrong? Yes. Sometimes this is the case. Sometimes it's the case where a minority view can be right and the majority could be wrong. After all, Winston Churchill himself warned. He warned the world about Hitler. He was a Nazi-phobe. He was ridiculed for being a Nazi-phobe. He was called a Nazi-phobe. He wasn't elected because of his stand. In fact, in the parliament, Lady Astor hated him. She was an extreme liberal, you know. She hated him very much. She said to him, Winston Churchill, I hate you so much. If I was your wife, I will put poison in your tea. And he looked at her and he said, ma'am, if I was your husband, I would gladly drink it. Yet nobody here today is willing to tell me that Winston Churchill was wrong. Why? And the same thing happens again when you see, all these peace, talk about peace movements. And I get chewed out all the time. How come you don't join one of those peace movements and peace now and peace this and peace that? It seems to me like, you know, the big complaint is we need to stop the cycle of violence. The problem is the cycle of violence we have to end. Sometimes what we have to end is the cycle of false peace. Because most Americans never heard the term hudna. Anybody heard the term hudna? 1, 2, 3, 4. Hudna, H-U-D-N-A. Look it up. Go home and Google it. H-U-D-N-A. It means ceasefire. It is the only concept that you can find in Islam to offer a peace treaty to the enemy, and it's called a ceasefire, and it's used in Islam in two occasions when you need to get concessions and when you need to regain strength. In fact, Sheikh Qaradawi, the most prominent Muslim figure, one of the most prominent Muslim teachers in the Sunni Muslim world, Sheikh Qaradawi, who is now a council of fatwa in Europe. Can you imagine the EU hired him for a council of fatwa? I have footage that will show you Sheikh Qaradawi. You'll be shocked. He was giving an example. Sheikh Qaradawi gave an example Salahuddin, Saladin. Saladin was once asked, he had war with the Crusaders, and he was asked the question by his advisor. He says, the Crusaders want to establish peace treaty, Hudna. And he said, should we establish the peace treaty with them? And Salahuddin said, well, what do you think? He says, well, the Quran says, if they concede to peace, then you must concede to peace as well. Salahuddin looked at him. He says, you are an Arab. You should know the Quran better than me. And I'm a Kurd. He's from Kurdistan. But I say to you, the Quran also says, why should you seek peace when you have the upper hand? In other words, when you're strong, there's no need to seek peace. Americans thought of Oslo as the Oslo Peace Accord. And in the Middle East, it's called the Oslo Hudna Accord, in which Yasser Arafat didn't know that he was being filmed in the mosques, saying to everybody, saying, this is a Hudna example of the Prophet Muhammad when he established Hudna with Quraysh, and he broke the treaty in the middle, and they asked him, why did you break the treaty? And he says, there is no treaties with non-Muslims. There's no binding agreements with a peace treaty with non-Muslims. In fact, a Hudna can be established in Islam up to 10 years, but you must break it before the 10 years are over. So there you have it. In fact, Faisal Husseini said it very clearly. He said it to the, you know, to the Middle East. He said, this is the Trojan horse. You know, the story of the Trojan horse, I don't have to tell you a whole story here today. What you understand in the West is not the way we understand things in the East. You can't compare apples with oranges. The first honor killing in our area, I remember when the father killed his daughter, and the Israelis arrested the man. He decapitated her for doing something wrong, and the Israelis, of course, arrested him, and the entire community gathered together, and they raised a fund to bail him out. Now, you might think there is a lot of things that are wrong with American society. I mean, somebody could open fire on a McDonald's, kill children. There's all kinds of evil things that goes on around, even here in America. In Israel, there was an Israeli soldier who opened fire and killed 50-some Palestinians in the Abrahamic Mosque in Hebron, which is both a Jewish holy place and a Muslim holy place. But the difference is this. The difference is when somebody commits such an atrocious act, the reaction of the community is totally different in the Middle East than it is in the West. Even when Sharon, let's say, regarding the Sabra and Shatila massacre, which the Israelis didn't commit, by the way, but however, because Israel took upon itself the responsibility, since Sharon was there and did not prevent it, you had 200,000 Israelis demonstrate in the streets calling for the resignation of Sharon. You don't have that in the Middle East. When was the last time you've seen demonstrations when there are problems all over the Middle East? I mean, the Saudis mistreat the Shia minority. In Pakistan, they mistreat Bengals. Afghanistan has killed each other. You had the Darfur issue. You have the Damour massacre in Lebanon. You don't really see demonstrations when non-Muslims are being killed. You had the Armenian genocide. You had the Smyrna genocide. Millions were killed in these genocides. And in Sudan, you had 1.5 million Christians killed. Where are the demonstrations? Where are the conscientious objectors? What is it that's different between here and between there? And the reason is, I believe, is because in America, we have what is called a Judeo-Christian culture. You know, you're a product of a Judeo-Christian culture. As much as you reject it, that's what this country was. And it's much different in the Middle East. I began to understand, my eyes were opened regarding these things. I began to get blamed as a person who lost my roots because I converted to Christianity. Again, I always like to tell my friends from back home that I was born in Bethlehem, and Jesus of Nazareth was also born in Bethlehem. I adopted a faith that comes from a person that's from my village. Actually, I'm very loyal. However, you know, you adopted a religion that comes from the desert of Arabia. You know, why am I not loyal? I am very loyal. It is not wrong to have your freedom of speech, your freedom of religion. It is not wrong to critique religions. Critiquing religions is the right of every American citizen. Critiquing religions is our freedom of expression. It is not racism. It is not Islamophobia. And it is nothing these things they accuse us of. How much time do we have? Wrap it up. Was that, look, you're giving me the whole time to cue anything? Why don't you say something? All right. I will shut my mouth and we will take Q&A. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Feel free to line up at either of these microphones and we'll take as many questions as we can. The more people that ask questions as opposed to making long declarations, the more people can get up to the mic. So please be courteous for the other people waiting in line.
Okay, well, I just want to, well, to begin, remind the audience that in chapter 49, verse 11 of the Quran, it says, "Let not one person deride another, nor defame one another, nor insult one another by name calling." I think tonight here we've just heard a speech meant to sow division and mistrust among the members of a moderate, multicultural, and pluralistic America. In a real sense, our speaker thrives upon the controversy surrounding his comments, part of a very profitable, thousands of dollars per speech commercial industry, an enterprise that creates and sustains bigoted opinions about a world faith.
Excuse me, is this a speech? You can get your own hold, pay your own thousands of dollars, give your own speeches as much as you want. You quoted a verse in the Quran, you know, about all this being antagonistic towards one another, and I didn't seem to see this behavior in you when you stood there screaming at the gentleman who came towards you. You actually contradicted the very verse you read. I don't understand that. Second of all, I can get these verses from the Bible too. You know, it's all over the place, you know, to be humble, humility. I can give you this very thing, talking about this humility towards one another, of a poetry, a very well-known poetry among Muslims, talking about how a good Muslim is supposed to go to the mosque, and at night time sometimes he washes the mosque, and at home he goes towards his children and they come running to him. And then it metamorphosizes into this other thing. At nighttime, he has these dreams. He is all the way in the historic parts in long time ago, fighting in these battles. And he is in Chechnya, and he is in Lebanon, and he is here, and he is there. He is cutting heads off. And, you know, this is all in the much of the poetry that we learned. So how does that fit, that verse that you quoted? You know, it is one thing to quote a simple verse out of, you know, from one part of the Quran, and there is much of the Quran that teaches peace. But however, if you want to teach the Quran in a very peaceful fashion and act upon it, and you want to say that the hadith that talks about jihad all over the world, decapitations and what have you, and if you meet the unbelievers, strike off their necks, if you want to interpret those as peaceful verses, I am willing to understand and accept your interpretation of these peaceful verses. As a matter of fact, I am also willing to demonstrate in the streets accepting your peaceful interpretation of these Quranic verses. I have no problem with you interpreting the Quran peacefully. However, this is not the case in the Middle East. In the Middle East, in the schools, they don't interpret these things peacefully. They don't interpret the Makkiyan surahs. Well, there are many peaceful verses in the Makkiyan surahs. But when you get to the Madaniyan surahs, you say, well, there is here violence and there is here peace. Well, then you have a nasikh wal mansukh, the abrogating verses and the abrogated verses. Most Americans have never heard of a nasikh wal mansukh. How could the peaceful verses be abrogated by the verse of the sword in chapter 9? Lay for them, hide, seek them, kill the unbelievers wherever you find them, of the people of the book, the people of the Bible, and what have you. That is not how they interpret this in the Middle East. They don't interpret it peacefully. You look at all four schools of thought, whether it's a Shafi'i, Hanbali, Maliki, they all interpret jihad by the sword. And you see jihad, I mean, how did the Islamic movement win when took over North Africa, took over Spain, occupied much of the Middle East and most of the ancient world? Did they occupy it by simple proselytization? Or did they occupy it by the sword? Can you research the word sword? And why are you so upset that I critiqued Islamic religion? Why does that offend you so much that you scream and you can't even handle yourself and it looked like you needed oxygen? Why can't you calm down and have a very intelligent or very, dignifiable conversation with respect? I don't understand that from the Middle East. Next challenger, please.
Hi. I just want to make sure this is all right, that I'm going to premise my question. It'll be way shorter. Don't even worry, everybody. All right. So I'm both Lebanese and a Muslim. And as you know, Lebanon is a country with a lot of different religions, and we have coexistence. We've had civil strife.
I'm sorry, right? It doesn't have civil strife in Lebanon?
No, I said we've had civil strife. We've had. There's been problems in Lebanon, obviously.
Had or have?
Had and have, both.
Okay, good. Okay.
Right, okay.
Fair
yeah.
enough.
Yeah. I'm not, no, this does not have anything to do with the question. Okay, so being a Muslim in this country, right, and I got to say I was shocked by a lot of the things you say about the Muslim perspective in the Middle East, because my family lives in the Middle East, and I'm Muslim, and I know the perspective, and I've never heard the kind of hatred you've talked about, and maybe that's just me, and maybe that's just my family, and maybe we're the anomaly, and maybe we're the only good people in the world. You know, that'd be great, in the Middle East at least, right? So, one second. So, the point is that how... And this is a problem in Europe too, just as you mentioned, with Muslims integrating in Europe. What is the solution you propose for people like me, people like most Muslims, I feel like, in the world, most Arabs, most Christian Arabs too, that we coexist with in Lebanon, right? Most people that just want to live, most people that just want to go to school. This is most people. You're talking about a small group. And I feel like the techniques that were used on you as a child, right, to brainwash you, are the same things that you're doing right now to these people here. And hold on. And I'm asking, what is the solution you propose? Because what is this based on? What do you want us to do? So you're telling people that aren't Muslim to be afraid of other Muslims because all they want to do is hate Christians and Jews. Where does that put me tomorrow morning?
Okay, are you done?
Yes, I'm asking you, what's the solution you propose?
Okay, let me understand here what you just said. You said that you live in Lebanon and, you know, it seems that the Muslims don't learn these things and what have you, and this is just an isolated thing. So when you see footage of Nasrallah standing there with hundreds of thousands of people, and we say it every year, وَنُكَرِّرُهَا كُلِّ عَامٍ الموت لأمريكا, death to America, hundreds of thousands of people jeering after him, death to America, is all my fabrication? Is that all my fabrication? When you see thousands of men marching in the streets of Lebanon, goose style, like Nazi style, with this, marching in the streets of Lebanon, and the entire community there, hundreds of thousands, parading and clapping their hands, are simply an isolated environment.
You're not answering my question. What do I do? What do you propose I do?
Well, the first thing you could do is start supporting a war against terrorism. When was the last time I have seen the American Muslim Council, Council of American Islamic Relations, the American Muslim Society participate in a serious effort to eradicate terrorism, in a serious effort to start closing down some of those mosques that are being funded by billions of dollars of Saudi money in America that are brainwashing kids. And another gentleman here said that, you know, I'm being paid thousands of dollars. Did they forget that Yasser Arafat collected hundreds of millions of dollars in Swiss account? He was the one that got paid. Did you forget Osama bin Laden collecting billions of dollars from zakah money from all over the Muslim world for terrorism? He was being paid. All these people were being paid. Terrorists are being paid here. Yes.
Welcome to USSB. As much as I disagree with your opinion, I'm a Palestinian Lebanese Muslim and a professor here, actually. And what is saddening to me is that a lot of the rhetoric that I hear you use, it's all encompassing, and it's very. I study persuasion. If you study some of the dictators who speak against, even Nazi, even Hitler.
So I'm Hitler?
He uses. No, I'm not saying that, but I'm saying the rhetoric you use is all encompassing and hateful and depersonalizing. And so that, for example, take a quick, just a second, please. I just want to take a quick, and this is risky, I don't know anyone here. How many of you are Muslim, know well Muslims, grew up in Palestine, or know the Palestinian people? Please raise your hand if you know them. Okay. Now, look around. There's a few of us, not many of us. How many of you, the views that he's expressed, ring true to you? None. Now here's one or two. Now here's the problem, is Jews were spoken of in sort of all-encompassing ways, and what the result was that people followed because people were scared to speak up and say, that does not represent me. And here, for the many that raise their hand, they're saying, this does not represent me. So do you have something to tell us about how your rhetoric is not all-encompassing, does not group people as depersonalize them in such a way where it might produce violence against either Muslims or Palestinians?
Listen. I have my best friend. His name is Muhammad. He is from Afghanistan. We have business together. All my employees are Muslims from Afghanistan. Every single employee I have in my businesses is a Muslim from Afghanistan. So if you're going to come to me and tell me that I'm anti-Muslim and I hate Muslims and I'm a hate monger, you're full of crap. Because why is it that I hire Muslims? As a matter of fact, I defended a group of Muslims who, you know, came from Afghanistan after the war, and they didn't speak good English, and they had hot dog carts. I went to the city, and I stood with them, defended them, and won the, you know, and basically pleaded for them in the behalf of the city council, and won for them in order to keep their businesses. So this idea that you're trying to paint me as an Islamophobe or anti-Muslim or what have you is utter nonsense and utter rubbish. So how you know, people can make judgments without even knowing the person, just like haphazardly like this, is to me is a shameful thing. Because the only things I talked about is fundamental Islam. Now, you support fundamental Islam? Then if you support fundamental Islam, you should not like my speech at all. If you don't support fundamental Islam and you asked me over there, what should we do? Then why don't we support each other in fighting terrorism together? Again, where are these organizations? Go ahead.
Thank you. If you could quickly comment on Israel's absorption of refugees in 1948 from Arab countries who were Jewish, do you think that could lead to a solution in the...
Well, let me answer that question first. Now you have the refugee problem. When you hear the word refugee problem as Americans, the first thing that comes to your mind is what? Palestinian refugee problem, right? But, however, historically speaking, the greatest historical refugee problem in the world was what? A Jewish refugee problem. Now, but you might think that the Arabs had nothing to do with a Jewish refugee problem. Why should they pay for something that was done by Nazism? That's not true. Most Americans don't know that you have 850,000 Jews forced, taking their homes from the Arab countries all across the Arab world. Homes stay confiscated, land confiscated, monies, bank accounts confiscated, had nowhere else to go but to Israel. Now, you have a Palestinian refugee problem and you have a Jewish refugee problem. Now, it's unfortunate when there is refugee problems on both sides. The Palestinians want to have a right of return, حق العودة, the right of return, basically bring all the Palestinians back to Israel. However, there is a simpler solution to the problem. There should be no right of return for anybody. The Arabs have no right of return to Israel, and the Jews should have no right to return to the Arab world. However, Jewish people accept this fate. The Arabs don't. Why? Why the Jews accept it, and the Arabs don't accept that fate? We had several refugee problem exchanges. We can quote tons of refugee problem, and there is not a single request anywhere in the world. We can talk about refugee problems, about India, Pakistan. There is no cries for solving refugee problems anywhere else, except in that little small land called Israel. Why? You wonder why? I think the answer is very simple. After examining my culture, and after examining all the lies that I see permeating here even, after examining all this stuff, I began to understand the answer is simple. And the answer is racism. Racism at a pandemic scale. While the racists will accuse the ones who are fighting racism of what? Racism. That's exactly what they do. You know, you're a racist, you're an Islamophobe, you're this. I am fighting racism. How am I a racist if I am fighting for the Jews to have a right to live? If I'm a racist, I'd hate Jews. I'm not a racist. Okay, so I hope that answered, that's as much as I can give you about the absorption problem.